Welcome to the Psych Experience.
Welcome back, everyone, to Psych Experience, the podcast for those who love what, Dr. Nadi?
For those who think we could be doing a better job with
intro, because a better job with the intro and with mental health, right?
Oh, with the intro. I was naively referring to mental health care.
But no. Yeah,
the intro could be... No, I think I like it. I'm growing particularly fond of our intro, so...
Okay, so we are here today to continue our conversation about symptom base rate. It's very important to remember that we do have a part one for this episode. So if you didn't listen to that yet, don't forget to go check that out before you start this one.
Okay, so before I even go there, as we move forward, if the listener is interested in the references, they can email us and ask, and I can send it directly to them. The references of the articles we mentioned in the previous articles and the ones that we're going to mention today.
You're referring to the book Symptom Base Rate, is that correct?
Yeah, that too, but also the specific articles, because the Symptoms Base Rate is just this endless, it's a book full of tables with references saying what they have found, percentages of symptoms and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always useful to go directly to the actual articles to understand how that data was driven. Taken from the article, but yeah. So let's just start today about ADHD. And on the same line of the previous episode, you know, we're pretty much looking for symptoms that are present or part of a given syndrome, but they're not very reliable when it comes to identifying the syndrome because they're also highly prevalent in the normal population without any said diagnosis. So the first paper I'm going to mention is, I'm going to butcher this name, Shaughnessy.
We've all been there, bro.
1994, oh boy, I didn't even say. S-C-H-A-U-G-H-E-N-C-Y, 1994. Well, this is what it matters. Please email us. And that's now you know why I told you guys to email us. He paired 27 folks... 18-year-old males, 27 18-year-old males with ADHD, with 397 18-year-old males without ADHD. And he found the prevalence of inattention or difficulties with attention of 45.5% on the kids with ADHD and 36.9% on the kids without ADHD.
Hmm.
So the method of report was an interview and questionnaire filled by a family member. So we have a prevalence of 45% of kids with ADHD reporting or being reported as having issues with attention, and that's among the ADHD kids, and 45 versus 36% on the kids without ADHD. So 45 versus 36. This shows that reports of inattention are hardly sufficient for a diagnosis of ADHD. On the same article, he compared 18-year-old girls with a diagnosis with a total of 16 girls that are 18 years old, mm-hmm, that have ADHD were compared to 394 18-year-old girls without ADHD. So same range, same age. In the previous episode, we spoke about, you know, matching. This is a perfect article for that argument.
Right.
Matching age, matching gender. There was something about, you know, race and stuff. So he found 61% of girls with inattention in the group with ADHD and 33% in the group without ADHD. Now you see, for that specific group, inattention is much more relevant than it is for kids, according to this paper, for boys.
Hmm.
For girls, for boys. Is it still bad? Is it still...
Yeah, that's really scary.
Yeah, it's not good enough yet, right?
Yeah.
And he did the same for... 15-year-old boys and girls. And the results were quite similar, which shows, you know... Inattention alone, and for some reason, every time someone says inattention in the general population, lay population, or unfortunately, some professionals, the first thing that pops their minds are ADHD, right? The first thing to be ruled out. And as you say, that's quite scary. Now, there are no doubts that some kids are less attentive than others, more restless or impulsive than others. and that it results in a lot of suffering for the kid and the family. We get that. That's not the problem. We're not questioning the existence of the diagnosis. This paper covered impulsivity as well, and the results were similar in the sense that it discredits the selection of symptoms, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So you have restlessness, you have inattention, and those two things are quite prevalent in normal population. Then, you know, what makes the difference? When shall we give a stimulant or a medication for that?
So impairment should be the distinguishing symptom?
Yeah. So impairment is the ultimate symptom that determines the presence of a disorder. But that is true for all disorders. So what disorders are we talking about here? Because for one, the symptoms seem to be as prevalent in general population as they are in a diagnosed population. Second, inattention and impulsivity are not exclusive of ADHD. Mm-hmm. For example, trouble concentrating or inattention is present in at least 30% of folks with anxiety disorders, associated with trying to quit smoking, for example. So there's a bunch of stuff causing restlessness and inattention. Mm-hmm. The same study we mentioned in the bipolar episode, the Lewinson, found that amongst 97 16-year-old kids, 37% of those kids had distractibility, mm-hmm. and they had no diagnosis. So attention impairment was found in 10% of an adult sample of folks with, cardiac disease attending sessions in a rehab center. 10% of attention, 10% of attention impairment in folks with cardiac disease.
But again, syndromes are more than one or two symptoms, right?
Yeah, but you know, if a given criteria has many symptoms that are either shared with other disorders or with common or general population, those criteria, we have to ask ourselves, are those criteria really useful in mm-hmm. determining why someone has an impairment? Because we're looking for the impairment, right? What is causing the impairment? A bunch of stuff can cause impairment. Even things that have nothing to do with psychiatric diagnosis can cause impairment, right? Mm-hmm. You can have an impairment in your life, your ability to work and everything like that. We need all this group of symptoms, but when you realize all this group of symptoms happen nearly at random out there, and they can be also associated with other disorders, the impairment per se may say, okay, there seems to be a syndrome here, buddy, mm-hmm. but it doesn't tell you what syndrome we're talking about.
So ideally, diagnostic criteria would comprise symptoms that, when present, point towards the existence of a given diagnosis, and if absent, points to the exclusion of that diagnosis. Is that correct?
Bingo, perfect. And to that property of the symptoms, we refer as positive predictive power. Uh-huh. Meaning, what is the likelihood of a diagnosis given the presence of a symptom? And then there's the negative predictive power, meaning how likely a diagnosis is to be absent if a given symptom is absent.
We don't seem to have enough for bipolar. Do we have enough for ADHD?
We have a bit, but I wouldn't call it enough, but it gives you, and as I said in the previous session, you know, if we ever put together a webinar in that regard, mm-hmm. We have a few things that could be used in a clinical from a clinical perspective when things are not quite clear. There's a study that attempted to differentiate between ADHD, ODD, and conduct disorder. Now, not only there's a lot of overlap in terms of symptoms of those disorders, they also seem to happen in the same folks with some frequency. Mm-hmm. So the study conducted by Pelham showed that the symptoms with the highest positive predictive power for ADHD were, and I'm quoting now, engaging in dangerous activities and interrupting. Mm. Now, this was a questionnaire to cover OCD and CD as well. So engaging in dangerous activities is not even an ADHD criteria anymore. It was by then. Now, negative predictive power of ADHD symptoms was quite high for nearly all symptoms of both ODD and ADHD. The highest positive predictive power for ODD in that specific sample was for being vindictive and using obscene language. So there is some stuff out there, and this question matters particularly because of not only there's overlap of symptoms among those diagnoses, mm-hmm. There also seems to be a biological, maybe genetic commonalities between those diagnoses, like people with ADHD will have kids with ODD or CD or ADHD, and kids with guys, they seem to belong to the same genetic pool somehow. So being able to differentiate between them is very important. And one of the reasons is ADHD is going to be treated with stimulants. The presence of conduct disorder is a predictor of substance use later. And if they are together and we were to use our brains, maybe for those kids, stimulants should not be the first choice. We should expose them to other stuff.
Mm-hmm. And is that sufficient?
Not by far. No, not by far. Even though there's more, we can use these things as a guide, but there's many limitations, you know, especially when working with adults. But I think in general, even though the research was not like, wow, ginormous and everything like that, and it's not like replicated 1,000 times because, you know, compared to drug research, someone says, oh, this is good for that. And then you have a guy show in one article, and then another guy shows in another article, then comes a negative study, and then has another 10 positive studies. Come on, someone comes and says, all right, let's do a meta-analysis. And then you have a final approximation of what the truth may be. This medication seems to be useful for that disorder or is not, right? Now, in the field of phenomenology, we don't have enough yet to gather information that easily and say, this is approximation from the truth. We looked into 10,000 kids, compared them with another 10,000, or let's say 2,000, for God's sakes, 1,000. And we compared to with ADHD, and we compared 1,000 kids without ADHD from different studies using the same resources, the same measurements. And the conclusion is, this is what ADHD should look like, and this is what doesn't look like, despite the... We don't have that enough, unfortunately. But I always think it's better to know those things and try to make a bridge in clinical work than not to know them and just work blindly.
Okay, I wanted to take a step back right here. Why is it different to deal with adults?
Oh, okay. So those studies were done with kids, right? So you have the parents watching them, teachers watching them, filling questionnaires and things, describing the kid according to all kinds of parameters. My interest in the matter of adults with ADHD comes from the fact that outpatient psychiatry faces an army of adults who were or were not diagnosed with ADHD in their childhood, claiming that they have ADHD. And usually, of course, it's because their attention is impaired. And with some frequency, the patients are quite invested in the possibility, to the point of hostility. You know, like reasons that we don't have to speculate today.
Candy?
I think that's I'm sure that's at least a small part of it. But there are other factors, I think, that are pretty clear, and, you know, it's useful to know. So, you know, so you can approach them properly in a session. The challenge I'm referring to do with adults is that the whole interview is based on what they have had regarding symptoms. You know, because the diagnostic criteria for ADHD involves having some degree of the presentation already noticeable before they were 12 years old, which is, okay, so for kids, no-brainer, right? Ask the parents, ask the teachers to check the kid, rule out the differentials, and this is still a freaking nearly impossible task, as we are seeing. With adults now, I'm asking him, how did you do in school from 7 to 12? And also the ways of interviewing, you know? Because the presence of those symptoms in adulthood is a very unreliable measure of the presence of the diagnosis, even worse than in kids. Like an adult that complains of impaired focus, like really, like, all right, welcome to the club. So then we have to introduce those symptoms. Like, for example, so another study done by Lando shows as decent positive predictive power the following symptoms. The following symptom pushes ahead in line, among a couple of others. Now, an adult is no longer pushing ahead in line, so the interview needs to cover his memories of doing so. Now, even though we don't have research on that kind of stuff, meaning what is recalled or not in an adult that had ADHD that was undiagnosed when he was a kid, and how do you know he had ADHD now because he's an adult, blah, blah, blah. So there are some other items from other papers that all together and asked the right way during the interview and the right time seem to minimize, or we would hope would minimize, and again, that's a topic for deep clinical discussion, seem to minimize the patient's intentions to get a diagnosis, as it seems, for some reason, is a highly desirable diagnosis, and again, for a set of different reasons.
So what's the solution then?
I think the doable for now is to cover those publications with a fair amount of discussion and incorporate it into your practice, as we have been doing. As doing it seems better than not doing it. It seems better to do than not to do. You know, we have some research saying, would you, is it, here's a obvious example. Asking an adult if he was pushing people in line when he was a kid is better than not asking. Trying to figure if that was present in those, because the research claiming that there's adult onset ADHD is really not convincing.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say that. It was a lot of effort, a lot of people interviewed, but the methods of interviewing, the fact that a lot of other stuff is not ruled out. I mean, inattention is prevalent in people with anxiety. Adult life is tough, buddy. Right? So in a perfect world, DSM would be based on a massive amount of equivalent research, that like the ones we mentioned above. And we will be at least better at diagnosing syndromes, you know, while the biological markers don't pop up, which will probably help the quest for biological markers. If we had a better cutoff of what we're looking for, you know, but that's where we are right now.
Okay, I think this concludes today's topic. It was a good talk. As always, I would like to remind our listeners that we do have other episodes available for this podcast. If you want to check them out, you can go to anypmi.org. It was a pleasure to have you here, Dr. Nardi.
Amazing. And if you guys want the references for the studies, or if you are interested in a webinar or something, just shoot us an email and we're going to put it together. Thank you.
This podcast was offered by anypmi.org.